Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. You can listen and subscribe to the show for free on Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. For network or show information, visit ByteRadio.me. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Dr. Judy Suzanne Rice-Sofrier, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Sacred Psychiatry, Bridging the Personal and Transpersonal to Transform Health and Consciousness. In Sacred Psychiatry, you'll be introduced to a diverse range of holistic approaches to healing. This book offers invaluable guidance on how to develop a personal spiritual practice and highlights the profound significance of fulfilling the soul's purpose. It illustrates the usefulness of astrology, emphasizes how toxic relationships undermine healing, and showcases the remarkable healing power of food as medicine. Sacred Psychiatry also provides a holistic framework for weaning off of psychiatric pharmaceuticals and highlights the treatable but frequently overlooked complex chronic conditions such as mold toxicity, mast cell activation syndrome, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So Freer is a holistic healer with a private psychiatry and psychoanalysis practice in Newton, Massachusetts. She is a board-certified adult and child psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, is on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and the Boston Psychoanalytic Institute, and teaches and supervises at the Cambridge Health Alliance. For more information, you could visit her website, which is www.judysofrier.com, and that's Judy, TSAFRIRMD.com. Okay, so welcome, Judy, to the show. Thanks for joining
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Such an honor.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, to me, it was really refreshing to read a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst approach to treatment in a holistic way, you know, and to me, it just, you know, really kind of opens the door to you know, being able to handle, you know, difficulties. It's kind of like, you know, there are multiple tools that you use rather than just one simple, you know, maybe conventional type of approach.
Right. There really is only one tool for the most part in conventional psychiatry, and that is just to identify symptoms and then suppress them with pharmaceuticals. And if that is not effective, then you change and you pick a different medication. And if you have side effects, you give yet another medication. And there's just so many other things that can be done that are so much more helpful and make so much more sense to try before reaching for the prescription pad, in my view.
I agree completely. So can you maybe share with us a little bit about your journey, in particular, you know, the shift from that conventional practice to one that's holistic?
Yes. Well, I never was entirely conventional because just the fact that I was a psychiatrist who was also a psychoanalyst is not that common. And before my practice changed and expanded and transformed, I was mostly doing psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, so I was mostly a talking doctor, and I would talk with my patients, and that was my primary mode of healing. I would sometimes prescribe medications, but it was not at all what I did first or most or regularly. And then in 2005, I had a series of losses that kind of opened me up spiritually. Both my parents died within 3 months of each other, and my marriage ended, and I had 3 young children, and I was kind of putting one foot in front of another because all of that sort of happened at the same time, and it prompted me to consult an astrologer for the first time. And at that time, I was about 48, 49 years old, and it's the time of what's called the Chiron return. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but it's a time when, I mean, many patients come to see me in my practice when they are that age, when they are 49, 50, 51. For women, it's a time of biological transition from the reproductive years to the years when that is no longer the focus. And so things change hormonally. But there's also just mortality becomes more in focus for people at that age, and there's a sort of drive to spiritualize the life. And so I was that age when all of those losses happened at the same time, and I consulted an astrologer for the first time. And astrology was also not totally foreign to me because my dad, who was also a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, was interested in astrology as well, but he was very much in the closet about it. He was a professor of psychiatry and, you know, didn't want to ruin his reputation, but I grew up with it around my home. But I consulted an astrologer for the first time in that context, and I was so intrigued and astonished by her insight into me and my life and what my experience was that I went back to consult her multiple times about various people in my life, my children, my parents, my partners. I just wanted to understand more about it and eventually resolved to become an astrologer myself and engaged in a in-depth course of study of astrology. And that kind of was like the gateway for me getting interested in other holistic modes of healing. And so I studied functional medicine and the connection between the gut and the brain. And my practice just started to morph, and I started to include many different modalities in it compared to when I was just only using talk therapy. And very importantly, one of the modalities that I feel is extremely important and very absent from the conventional approach is attention to the sacred dimension of life and a person's spiritual life and how important that can be in healing. But that's not a conversation that most psychiatrists or psychologists have with their patients. There's actually kind of an allergy to the sacred, and it's all like secular and based on the personality and maybe the biology as well, but not really looking for certainly nothing preventative, nothing about root causes, nothing about nutrition, nothing about all kinds of holistic approaches that can be so supportive to healing, and actually when you leave any of them out can really derail it.
When you mentioned your father's interest in astrology, kind of being in the closet and not wanting to, you know, impact his reputation, it seems that, you know, that's a very common fear, you know, and it's kind of strange talking about psychiatrists and psychologists and the fear, you know, of the kind of, you know, their reputation being rejected. But it does seem to be, you know, a fear. And do you think that it is getting better than what it may have been during your father's time?
I think it's getting better, but we have an enormously long way to go. There's a wonderful book written by a psychoanalyst. Her name was Liz B. Mayer. I think maybe Elizabeth is her real name, Mayer. She's no longer alive. She died very early. But the book is called Extraordinary Knowing, and it's all about therapists and clinicians who have all kinds of experiences of sort of non-ordinary experiences like telepathy or synchronicities that they don't let anybody else know about. They're afraid of being considered crazy, so they keep it very much in the closet. And it's a beautifully written book. And she was a kind of mainstream psychoanalyst, so it was very courageous of her to write that.
Yeah, that is. And over the years that I have done this show, I've had many medical professionals, doctors, or various, you know, forms, in some form in the medical profession, who have, whose paradigm was, you know, altered by, you know, some kind of, you know, sacred or mystical or, you know, unusual for them, you know, unusual experience that then forced them to reexamine, you know, their training and their purpose. And it seems that once it becomes a personal experience, that seems to be the catalyst for major change.
I think that's often really true, although sometimes people have these experiences, and as I said, in that book, Extraordinary Knowing, people were sitting with very strange experiences that they were afraid to tell anybody about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, with people like you who, you know, have expanded your, you know, your practice and your toolbox, you know, that, you know, maybe others will, you know, take refuge and you know, maybe follow suit. So now.
Right. And some patients come to see me for that reason, you know, because they have a sense that if they tell me certain things that I'm not going to say that they're crazy, you know, that I will be more open-minded listening to what their experiences have been.
Yeah, yeah, and you're less likely to jump on the pharmaceutical wagon, you know.
Exactly, Yeah.
So now, what would you say the conventional type of therapy can it be harmful? You know, to individuals, you know, because right now you were talking about how, you know, some people come to you because of your openness, to the sacred, you know, that dimension. So do you think that those practitioners who do not, you know, kind of aren't open to that dimension, you know, that may, in fact, be harmful to the patient?
Well, I mean, it certainly can be invalidating if a person is having a particular sort of spiritual experience and they're being told that it's some kind of defense against their fear or against, like I had a patient this morning tell me about somebody who had a very advanced case of multiple sclerosis, and she talked to my patient about how it had shifted her whole perception of life and how she was sort of grateful for every little thing in her life. And he made some kind of comment that it was like a defense against, like, dealing with the horror of her illness, which, you know, like, okay, you can frame it like that, but I don't agree with that. Like, I think that this woman he was describing really had some kind of spiritual opening that dealing with her condition had enabled. So, like, I mean, that was the patient saying this about another person, but I think, you know, I mean, Freud had some kind of conception that, like, a sense of the a sense of like connecting with something divine and something limitless and something oceanic was like some kind of infantile experience, rather than that it's an experience that's available to everyone if they open their heart and attune themselves to that frequency. And I mean, I don't know about, you know, like the denial of the sacred being, like specifically that being harmful, but there's so many harmful things. Like I recently heard about a patient who had smoked marijuana and then was hospitalized in a psychotic state and then put on, you know, some very intense medications for psychosis. But, okay, maybe that would be indicated to stabilize the person, but not to, like, leave them on it. So, like, people will get hospitalized because they're in some kind of extreme state, get started on medications, and then they won't get taken off of them. Like, very often it is possible to wean a person from medications. It's not necessary for them to be on them long term. It's like the condition that they were experiencing was due to like an adverse reaction to like a drug that they ingested, like marijuana. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of harm done by just putting people on medications and then leaving them on them. And also, I mean, it's been so common that consciousness is raising about this, but people are prescribed benzodiazepines, which is an anti-anxiety medicine, and they literally become terribly addicted to them and cannot get off of them. And then, you know, the conventional approach would be to wean them very quickly from it, and then they have horrendous withdrawal syndromes and really can be quite traumatized because of those withdrawal symptoms. It needs to be done very slowly and very skillfully to wean a patient from medicine, but it's quite possible in many cases. But, you know, if you try to do it too quickly and don't support the person in other ways, then it fails.
Right. Yeah, like in that example of the anxiety, I mean, if a person tried to wean them off the medication without giving them the tools to be able to, you know, cope with anxiety, you know, without the medicine, then it's, you know, it's basically going to force situations where they just, you know, any symptoms, any expression of anxiety is then kind of leading right back to the drug.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah. There's programs that people can do which kind of retrain their nervous system, their limbic system of their brain, and really calm down their autonomic nervous system. And I always recommend that to patients who are trying to get off of medications. I also recommend an anti-inflammatory diet, because if a person's body is inflamed, their brain is also inflamed, and that also creates, like, symptoms of anxiety. So much can be done with diet, you know, like, incredibly much can be done with diet. And, in fact, if a person isn't willing to make dietary modifications, I don't really want to work with them. You know, like, I just don't feel like I can be helpful, since I'm not really interested in prescribing medications to them. I think there's other things that can be done, but they require a lot of work and a lot of, like Margaret Mead said, it's easier to change a person's religion than to change their diet. it's hard, you know?
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, speaking of inflammation, in your book, you write about mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, as a powerful contributor to inflammation. Now, prior to your book, I had never heard of mast cells. And, I mean, it was just that whole section just was like, whoa, that was an eye-opener. So would you mind sharing with the listeners a little bit about what mast cells are, and, you know, and just how much they can contribute to ill health?
Yeah, that's a really great and important question. So mast cells are white cells that are part of the immune system. We all have them all over our bodies, and they're in the highest concentration in the places in our bodies that interface with the environment. So like our lungs that, you know, we exchange oxygen in our lungs with the air, and our gut where we come into contact with food. So there's the highest concentration of mast cells in those areas. And they orchestrate an immune response. They're filled with little granules that contain bioactive substances like histamine and serotonin. And when they are functioning well, there's some kind of stress that needs to be dealt with, some kind of invader or pathogen. And they come and they kind of put out their substances and they neutralize the danger. But in some people, and there can be a whole variety of reasons that the mast cells get dysfunctional and start, you know, degranulating in a chaotic way. So, like, conditions that can, like, I think long COVID is very often related to mast cell activation. Like, it's a virus, it's a response to the virus that just persists. And the mast cells are just releasing their substances and causing anxiety and depression and inflammation in the body and abdominal symptoms. So many symptoms, skin symptoms, any of these symptoms that are like high histamine, like hives and rashes, asthma, so many different conditions are related to the mast cells behaving in a dysfunctional way. And so you can have mast cell activation after a trauma, like the limbic system, which is a deep structure in the brain that is responsible for the fight or flight response, can get activated and dysregulated, and then it makes the mast cells degranulate, and the mast cells degranulating further dysregulates the limbic system. People who are exposed to toxic mold can have mast cell activation. People who have chronic Lyme disease can have mast cell activation. People who have chronic Epstein-Barr virus can have mast cell activation. A person can have mast cell activation after a car accident. Trauma can create it. So there are many, many different causes of it. In my view and the way that I've been trained by my mentors, it's important to look for the underlying cause, but you can create a lot of symptom relief by just stabilizing the mast cells, which can be done with antihistamines and quercetin, which is an analog of vitamin C, which stabilizes the membranes of the mast cells. There's pharmaceuticals that can be tried, and people, when their mast cells are calmed down, often feel much, much, much better. And if a doctor doesn't recognize that the person has mast cell activation, they come to see them and they're so anxious and they have all kinds of weird symptoms, they say, okay, you know, you should be taking an antidepressant or anti-anxiety medicine. But really what should happen is that they should be treating their mast cell activation and trying to figure out why they have it to begin with.
Yeah, so it sounds like because there are so many different symptoms that the diagnosis would be hard, would be sometimes hidden from
in that case, if the person gets referred to a psychiatrist, this is all in your head. It doesn't follow any kind of normal pattern, recognized pattern of illness.
Is there a test, to be able to determine whether, you know, the root is a mast cell dysfunction, or is it like, mm-hmm. you know, going through the various treatments like you mentioned, you know, is that the way to maybe backdoor a diagnosis?
Well, there's disagreement in the field. People do not agree about this. There's one expert, his name is Dr. Larry Afrin. He's written a book that's about 3 inches thick called Never Bet Against Occam, and he's a real expert in mast cell activation, and he likes to do very sophisticated blood tests to determine if a person has mast cell activation. The blood tests are, as far as I've understood, very often not drawn properly, not handled properly, and they don't give, like, accurate results because they have to be handled in such a specialized way. And my mentor does not advocate for using laboratory studies to diagnose mast cell activation. It's a clinical diagnosis. You see that a person has symptoms that are afflicting multiple organ systems, and you prescribe a regimen of treatment because the symptoms are suggestive, and then, you know, a person responds to the treatment, and that's how you make the diagnosis.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious because now, is this one of those that is, would be considered on a spectrum, you know, kind of, you know, some people would experience it maybe more intense than others?
Definitely. I mean, some people have mild versions of it, and some people are just very, very afflicted. They react to every single thing they eat. Even there's people that react to, like, drinking a glass of water. You know, their limbic system is so dysregulated and their mast cells are so activated and hypersensitive. There are people who have electro-hypersensitivity. They're reacting to, like, electromagnetic frequencies. They can't tolerate the computer. They can't tolerate the iPhone. There are even people who have to move to, like, particular areas of the country. There's one in West Virginia where there's no electromagnetic frequencies. Like, they've made it a zone that there is none of that there. Because some people are so, like, hypersensitive. And that is mediated by the mast cells.
Wow. This is amazing. Now, you mentioned limbic system, and in your work, you have something called the limbic system retraining. So, can you tell us, you know, a little bit about when that is something that you would utilize and what it is and, you know, when it should be looked at?
I recommend it to most of my patients. I mean, really, I mean, there is so much going on now on the planet that many, many, many people, like, even if they're not seeing a psychiatrist, they're in a state of chronic kind of fear and arousal and hypervigilance because of the news cycle of all of the wars and violence and the destabilization of the climate and the, you know, threat of climate collapse, and I mean, people are really afraid, the political dysfunction. So, I mean, limbic system retraining teaches you to calm down your autonomic nervous system, and it's done with a series of brain retraining exercises, and it's done with guided meditations. There's different programs. One of my favorites has been the Gupta program, G-U-P-T-A, which a patient downloads from the internet, and it costs like $400, and they work with it, and they have like a community, and there's all kinds of group exercises, but also it's just something that a person can do individually. They don't need a therapist to them. There's like everything is very clearly explained, but it's something that they have to practice. Like, it takes like, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes a day to practice calming down your nervous system this way. There's another one called DNRS, Dynamic Neural Retraining System. That one I don't like quite as much. There's just sort of the tone of it is not my favorite. And there's a new one that many patients have told me they just love. It's called Primal Trust. And that combines the limbic system retraining with exercises that tone the vagus nerve, which is also responsible for the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system response. So you want to just, like, calm down the person's nervous system. And, you know, like, if a person is weaning from medications or if they have had any kind of trauma, it's something that I recommend much more often than I don't. The times that I wouldn't recommend, that somebody already had a very robust meditation, mind-body practice, yoga practice, then I wouldn't. But anybody else, it's like, for me, like, foundational for helping them heal holistically.
Okay, great. Good resources for the listeners to check out. Right now, we're about halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we return, there was one aspect of your work called, talked about people having an importance of having a multidimensional sense of self. So that one, I'm real curious about that. So maybe we can talk about that when we come back, okay?
That would be great.
Good. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break. Hello. This is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder, we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to the more than 1,700 shows we have aired during the past 13 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, photography products and services, calendars, and greeting cards. There is also a link to our account at Fine Art America where you can purchase items such as mugs, prints, pillows, and more. Our show is available as a free podcast on multiple platforms such as iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, and Audible, with icons to each platform on our homepage. We are also available on social media platforms such as Facebook, X, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Threads. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my special guest is Dr. Judy Suzanne Rice Sofrier. And you can find out more about her book, Sacred Psychiatry, Bridging the Personal and Transpersonal to Transform Health and Consciousness, again, by visiting her website, which is www.judysofrier.com, and that's JudySafrmd.com. Okay, with that, we're back, Judy.
Yes, good to be back with you.
Great. Okay, thanks. So, the multidimensional, and the reason that I wanted to bring this up is, as I've kind of mentioned in some of my previous shows to some listeners, I had a dream, and I'm a very much a dream. I record all my dreams, and I look into them, and all that. I had one that was just so odd that I had never had before, and it was, where I had, looking at my reality, so to speak. And then there was all of a sudden a kind of another reality layering on top of that one. It's kind of like, creating a new one. But I mean, they were distinct, but also merged. So, I mean, it was just very, very odd. So the idea of a multidimensional sense of self is interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about your view of that and how that plays into, the role that it plays with healing?
Yes. So I was really happy when you brought that up as something you wanted to talk about, because that's one of the first chapters, maybe the first chapter of the book, and it's really the heart of the book, because there's so much that can be done to help a person feel with each other, with the larger world, with the universe, and it very much mitigates against a feeling of being alone and as though they're living in a chaotic and random world, there's many practices that people can do in order to feel more grounded and more connected. And patients come to me and they, like, maybe they were raised in a Catholic home or a Jewish home, and they didn't resonate with the practices that they experienced in their childhood, and they feel alienated from that, but they have a longing to have more connection with a spiritual life, and they, you know, they want that, but they don't know how to do it. So, you know, I talk with my patients about how do you develop a spiritual practice, because I think that it's at the very heart of healing. And so there's different things. Like I, sometimes I talk with them about, somebody who was a hero of mine. Her name, is Angelus Arian, and she's no longer alive. But she was a cultural anthropologist, and she went around the world and studied, cultures all over the world and their spiritual practices. And through her study of them, she identified three main practices that were common to different cultures around the world. And the first one was prayer. And so people like can be allergic to that word prayer, but the way of like asking for help or asking for guidance or listening to what's coming in. And like prayer is so important for a person to feel helped. And so that is one of the practices that she discovered around the world that people did as part of their spiritual life. And the second part that she identified was gratitude. And so, you know, gratitude is just saying thanks for all of our blessings. And they've done, I mean, there's been actual research done on people who do gratitude practices, and it's been clear that people who, like, write down three things every night before they go to bed that they're grateful for, when they do, like, happiness measurement scales, in a few months, they're measurably happier than those who don't do that practice. And so it's like really paying attention to what is good in your life, what are the blessings, rather than focusing upon, you know, what is lacking. Like when I mentioned that woman with MS, you know, like she was like suffering, but she was so grateful for so many different things. And, you know, she was having like an elevated experience despite the reality of the deterioration of her body. And the third practice is, let's see, there's prayer, gratitude, and sacred actions. You know, like it's like doing things that uplift another person, taking literal action, like making a donation or saying something kind or looking the cashier in the eye and thanking them and treating them as like a person instead of a function. And just being mindful with your behavior to create more goodness and beauty in the world, and like literally to do things. So, I mean, that was something that Angelus Arian identified all over the world that people did: prayer, gratitude, and sacred action. There's a book by Annie Lamott it's called The Three Essential Prayers: Help, Wow, Thanks. And help is like prayer, you know, like asking for help. Wow is, you know, just sort of wonder at, you know, the, like when you look up at the stars and you see, if you can see them where you're living, and you see the heavens or you see the flowers coming up in the spring, there's just so much to kind of wonder at. And thanks is to be grateful for things. And that really shifts things if you're able to do those three things like consistently. So when I talk with patients as well about like setting up an altar, like a sacred space, and it doesn't need to be like a whole dedicated room. It can be like a corner of a room or a table where they just put some objects that have some particular meaning to them, and maybe a vase of flowers, or maybe a beautiful rock or a shell, and just something that reminds them of the sacred dimension of themselves, so that, you know, they're just not like worn down by like the daily grind or of the news or the struggle to survive, that there's something more that they can tune into.
Right.
I talk with patients about using essential oils on points on their body that can stimulate particular spiritual experiences. The Chinese acupuncture points, they all have spiritual meanings. That is also something that I often talk about my patients with. So those are like some of the things.
Well, you know, when it comes to prayer, you know, I was one that was raised Catholic. I was an altar boy, learned Mass in Latin, which I didn't even know what I was saying, you know. But it was one of those cases where, you know, the dogma just didn't feel right, you know. And so I kind of went, you know, the pendulum swung the other way, where I was didn't want anything to do with, you know, any of it. But then recognizing prayer as being the a way of making a connection to, you know, the infinite, to God, to even if it's to your internal being, you know, that
right.
And so then from that point on, it was just like, okay, there's, you know, remove the dogma, you know, and recognize that, you know, this was, it's the fact that an individual can make that connection and he didn't need an intermediary to be able to talk and get guidance.
Right, absolutely. I mean, another thing that I talk with patients about is making offerings. You know, like it's a way of giving thanks and of having reverence, you know, to find like a particular, let's say, tree that they love, that they find beautiful, you know, and to like throw some rice or some grains or some beans, you know, and on the earth and say, thank you. And like help me with whatever it is that I need guidance and support and, it's just that connecting all the time just really changes things. And
it does make a difference.
Particularly important,
you know,
now.
I was just going to say, in today's world, you know, where people, even though there's that illusion of connection, you know, it really is an illusion. There's you know, people, you have so many friends, or, you know, they're posts get so much attention, you know, where in fact it's, you know, it isn't a heartfelt connection.
Yeah. It's something very anonymous in a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm going to go back to Chiron, you know, because, you know, we mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, you had that Chiron return, which, you know, kind of, you know, set you on the astrology path as well. And then I noticed that you also consider yourself a Chironic psychiatrist. So talk a little bit more about Chiron. And,
well, it fits,
you know,
very well into the what we were just talking about with the multidimensional, because Chiron is well, they have actually trouble characterizing and agreeing about what kind of body it is. But many people characterize it as an asteroid. And its orbit is goes between the planet Saturn and the planet Uranus. And Saturn is the last planet that is visible to the naked eye, like it's before the advent of the telescope. Like there was only like 7 planets seen, and Saturn was the last one. So Saturn is kind of the limit. And Saturn is like our material reality. It's like our body and just kind of, it's like the 3D world. Whereas Uranus is like, it's a reality that's beyond that. And Chiron weaves between Saturn and Uranus. So Chiron was a centaur. He was the product of a rape. And his mother, when she saw him, she was a nymph, and she was so horrified by his appearance that she rejected him and put him out to die. And he was adopted by Apollo and Diana, and they raised him, and they educated him, and he became like a very highly skilled astrologer, herbalist, shaman, medicine person, mathematician, musician. He was a polymath, and the kings all sent the sons, the Greek heroes, to be educated by Chiron. But something happened where Hercules, I mean, there's many versions of the myth. Hercules accidentally shot Chiron in the thigh with an arrow tipped with the blood of a hydra, and it created a wound that could not be healed. So this very, very skilled healer couldn't heal himself, and he was sort of in an ending agony. And then here's a parallel story of Prometheus, who gave the fire to mankind, to humankind, and the gods were angry and changed him to a rock, and the eagle came every day to peck out his liver, and his liver grew back. Well, Chiron felt very sorry for Prometheus, and so he offered to exchange places with him, because Chiron also couldn't die, because he was half, his father was Zeus and his mother was a nymph, so he was also immortal. So he changed places with Prometheus, and the gods were so impressed with his altruism that they released him as well and put him up in the sky as a constellation. But there's just also the idea with Chiron that we kind of save ourselves through acts of service. It's like by being helpful to other people that we really save ourselves. And in addition to that, like we all have wounds that we can't heal. You know, that there's just, there's things about certain experiences that we've had that we never, we can process and we can have a different relationship with them, but that they totally don't affect us anymore, that is often, you know, not possible. It's always something that is there, but we learn to deal with it differently. But, and it's very often through those very, very difficult experiences that we develop compassion for ourselves, for other people. We have, you know, spiritual growth through those wounding experiences.
Wow. That imagery of what Chiron represents is extensive. I mean, it's, I wouldn't say it's deep, you know, but it really does hit on many, many different levels. And now, do you, you know, the idea of a wound that cannot heal, do you feel, I mean, do you feel that there, that is always the case? I mean,
I don't know if it's always the case. I don't know if it's always the case, but there, you know, do you know the spiritual teacher Ram Dass?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, so he had this expression, become a connoisseur of your neuroses. You know, like, so you, like, know yourself. You know, like, you know what your, you know, the things that, you know, continue to, you know, that you're vulnerable to feelings about, even though you're maybe not going to behave the way that you did when you were younger, before you had worked on it as much, you know, you won't maybe be as derailed, but not that it's just like nothing. But I, you know, like,
right.
I mean, it may be that there are people who, you know, are able to like completely overcome. I can't say that sort of in some kind of definitive way, but in my experience, most people, you know, have wounds that they continue to process throughout their lifetime.
Yeah. You know, I mean, because what that reminded me of or made me think is that, for example, when with the loss of someone who you love, like a parent
yes.
or a child,
yes.
you know, that,
yes.
you know, that grief, you know, never goes away. But
no,
it's
no.
processed differently.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, I mean, it's you don't get over it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's still like a loss.
Yeah. Now there's another topic in your book that I kind of want to just touch on. Maybe might be the last one we have time for. But it's chapter 5 in your book called "Breaking Away from Energy Vampires." And you know, I've known a few. You know those. Blood-sucking, or energy-sucking, you know, folks that, you know, sometimes it's hard to recognize. It's kind of like when you're in the midst of being drained, you may not know it. So can you talk a little bit about the idea of energy vampires?
Yeah, well, you know, there are people in this lifetime who a person can get involved with, and it can be a relationship that isn't based on mutuality. Like one person mm-hmm. feels like they deserve everything, and the other person feels like they deserve nothing, and they're constantly accommodating and constantly trying to be in service and of assistance to the other person, and the other person is very accustomed to taking, and the other person is very accustomed to giving. And it's just not a relationship of reciprocity or mutuality. And, you know, there's been a lot of conditioning often for women that, you know, it's up to them to make a relationship work. So if things are unhappy, that they should just try harder. And sometimes it's very hard for them to see that the demands that are being made upon them are not appropriate, and that it's really toxic and it's really damaging to them. And you know, I see like quite a few people who have like chronic complex medical illness in addition to their psychiatric symptoms. I mean, the psychiatric symptoms are in a certain way a product of that chronic complex medical illness, but it's also a product of like what things were like growing up in childhood where, you know, they maybe had a parent who was very unable to attune to their needs and very much demanding that they behave in a certain way, and if they didn't, that they would be kind of emotionally iced out or criticized mm-hmm. or punished in some kind of way. And so they grow up expecting that that's what relationships are like. And I've yet to see somebody who is involved with a person who is really toxic to be able to really heal if they stay in that relationship. And there are, you know, sometimes, you know, like couples therapists, like most are trained to say it takes two to tango and what are each of the partners doing to contribute to the situation. Sometimes it's not mm-hmm. like that. There's one person who is really much less well than the other. And it's not an equal. The responsibility for the way things are is not shared equally. And as long as, like, the person who is, like, giving is being told that they need to kind of accommodate and adapt more, it's a disservice to that person. And I think there's some people who, you know, are malignantly narcissistic, another word for, like, an energy vampire. And I don't really think that it is very common that those people are able to change. They are usually not interested in being in therapy because they don't think they have a problem. Everybody else has a problem. And it may be just like not in this lifetime that they are going to be able to have like a loving, caring relationship. And the person who's involved with them really needs to get away from them.
Yeah. And it can be really tough, you know, particularly with if it's a family member or
yeah.
partner, yeah. that, you know, to be
father
to
of children, mother of children, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Very
exactly.
difficult.
Well, yeah, Judy, we're down to the last 5 minutes. So this hour has flown by. We haven't begun to talk about some of the wonderful topics in your book. But if you have, would you have any kind of last words for our listener, maybe something that you do or they can do on a daily basis, or, you know, some kind of activity that they can do to support, you know, their healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, well, there's something that I love that I put in my book. It's called the Three P's, and I learned about it from a Buddhist meditation teacher named Ruth King. And I remind myself of the Three P's all the time. It really helps me.
Okay.
First, I don't know what's the order, but one of the P's is that things aren't perfect. So, like, things always go wrong. There's always, like, stuff that happens, you know, and if you're somehow expecting that things shouldn't go wrong, then it's going to be a problem. Like, when things go wrong, it's like, okay, something goes wrong. This
mm-hmm.
happens in life, you know, like, things are not perfect, you know, or people disappoint you or whatever it is. And then the second P is that things aren't personal. Like, sometimes people behave in a way that really hurts your feelings, but it's really not about you. And it's a mistake to take it personally. This is about what's going on with them and the way they are looking at things. And it's a mistake to take it upon yourself and to blame yourself or to try to somehow make things right when it's not about you. This is their problem. It's not perfect, it's not personal, and it's not permanent. You know, like, whatever it is that you don't like, don't worry, it's going to change. Something else is going to happen. Something you like, don't get attached to it. It's also going to change. Like, things change just, like, all the time. And so those three P's are kind of guiding lights for me.
Great.
They help me in a lot of situations.
I'm going to commit those three P's to mind, you know, because, you know, I can think of many occasions where, you know, reminding myself of those would have benefited me, you know, in my perspective.
Yeah.
So.
All of us.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you, Judy, for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.
I love your book, and your approach to healing is wonderful. And I look forward to keeping in touch.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It was great to talk with you.
Great. You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Dr. Suzanne Rice-Sofrier, and we've been talking about her new book, Sacred Psychiatry, Bridging the Personal and Transpersonal to Transform Health and Consciousness, and definitely book, which is available at Amazon and everywhere you get your books. And you can also visit her website, which is www.judysofrier.com, and that's JUDYTSAFRIRMD.com. She's got some a blog on there and some wonderful videos that she did with another psychiatrist. Judy, what is the name of that show that you had with the other psychiatrist?
Two holistic psychiatrists talking.
That's it. Two holistic psychiatrists talking. Great. Thank you. Yeah, I went through and watched those, and I just wanted to make sure our listeners found those as well. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert. All right.
All right. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. And again, until we meet again,
thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To become a show follower, visit www.blogtalkradio.com/BikeRadioMe and click on the follow link. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bike Radio Me. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.